Thanks, everybody. My name's Sonia, and I'm an alcoholic. I am so glad to be here today. I want to thank the committee for inviting me. I want to thank Beth, my speaker buddy, Tyree, Holly, Jan, Maureen, and Paul. And I could go on because you've just all made me feel so welcome. I think it's one of the great things about this conference. I know it started with Harlan, but you're all carrying on the great tradition of making everyone here feel like we're a part of, and after all, that's what I've always wanted, was to be a part of. So I'm very grateful to be here and have appreciated your hospitality and spirit of inclusion. Your conference is living the dream. Living the dream, you know, and I used to think alcohol was my solution. You know, and I never realized that I needed a design for living in order to really live the dream. And it says in our book that this program will give us a new life, which is reasonably happy and purposeful. And I thought if my boss and my partner would make me happier, if I got more stuff, you know, if people recognized my true value, you know, that then when my life got better, I could be a little bit more purposeful and maybe think of you. And as Zan pointed out last night, you know, when Harlan first got involved in this conference, he found a purpose. You know, he found a purpose. And through that purpose in being one among, we find reasonable happiness. And that's what I found here too, just the opposite of how I thought it should work. So I'm really glad to be here today, and I love that that's the theme of the conference. So let me tell you how I got from there to here. I grew up in Chico, California. I grew up in a family that drank a lot. I never thought we were dysfunctional. I found out that after I got here. My parents drank a lot. They were, from the outside, we were a typical middle-class family. You know, it was from the inside where all the secrets happened that things were a little bit different. I had one relative that didn't drink, and that was my grandpa. And my grandpa, I'd never seen him drink, and I thought it was pretty abnormal. And so I asked him one time, I said, "Grandpa, why don't you drink?" And he said, "Well, you know, I drank a lot as a young man, and I found that whenever I was drinking, I had problems with my personality, and I got into trouble." Now, this was long before AA had come about. He said, "So I joined a church. I got really involved. I dedicated my life to others, and it's just worked out a lot better for me." And my grandpa was my favorite relative. He was the stability in my life. You know, when you're in a family that drinks all the time, unexpected things happen. You know, some people thought my family was violent. We referred to ourselves as demonstrative. Let me just tell you a couple things that describe my family. The first was, when I was a few months sober, my sponsor asked me, she said, "Is anyone in your family alcoholic?" And I said, "Oh, no, I'm the problem." And she said, "Oh, okay." And so shortly after that, my family was having Thanksgiving dinner. Now, I had not been to my family's house much at all since I got sober, because I drank with them a lot and I could not go there and stay sober. And in fact, I used to cry a lot because I thought that I would never be able to be around my family again. So when this Thanksgiving thing came up, I asked my family if I could bring my sponsor. Now, I had neglected to remember that often at our dinners, we didn't serve dinner. Well, we didn't even eat. It didn't seem like it was very important. And so I asked my sponsor, it was Julie, I said, "Would you like to come to Thanksgiving dinner?" And she said, "Sure." And everyone was on their best behavior, because this was the AA sponsor. They didn't even think I was alcoholic, and they would have been much happier if I was drinking. So Julie came to dinner, and my sister and brother-in-law are having Manhattans with beer chasers. My dad's having scotch. You know, dinner was reasonably on time. It was only about an hour late. It was a really special effort. And About 5 minutes before dinner, my mother came out and said, "Dinner will be in 5 minutes," and everyone got up and left the room. Julie said, "Where are they going?" I said, "They've gone to get the wine." "Okay," she said. I said, "I should have told you." She said, "Oh no, I've been around people that drink wine before. It's okay." So we all go into dinner and we have dinner, and shortly after dinner we excuse ourselves and leave for the meeting. And Julie said, "You know, I just want to point out a couple of things to you that you may not have noticed." She said, "You know, there are a lot of normal drinkers that don't drink Manhattans with beer chasers." And she said, "Quite often when I've gone to dinners where wine is served, everyone does not bring their own bottle." Yeah. Another incident comes to mind. By the way, things did change after I worked the steps and got some sobriety. My relationship with my family did begin to change. And, well, I tried to convince them all to be sober. They ended up telling me, please don't change their lifestyle just because it worked for me. But I could do my part, and I got to be a much better daughter. I said my family had a lot of secrets. I had friends that wouldn't eat dinner with us when we did eat because it upset their stomach with all the violence. And so one night we were at the dinner table and I had a twin sister, and my twin sister said something that my father didn't like. And he came from one end of the table to the other and he whapped her right across the mouth, and her nose is bleeding and her mouth is bleeding, and she gets up and she runs out the front door to start screaming in the neighborhood. We all get up from the table and run out the front door and tackle her, because there isn't too much with somebody getting the fist they deserved at dinner. There's not too much wrong with that. But by God, we better not let the neighbors know. And that pretty much typified my family. I didn't think my drinking interfered much with anything. I became a daily drinker when I was 17 years old. And only after I came to the program did I realize that my life began to change as a result of that, that those goals that had been so important when I wanted to be the kind of granddaughter that my grandfather would have approved of, that wasn't happening. You know, when I realized that the opportunities I would have had had disappeared, and I blamed every one of you for them, not myself. But I eventually got married. I was 26 years old when I got married. And I married a professional man. He was director of relations and development in the Cal State University system. And so we were in charge of a lot of social occasions. And we were both from drinking families. I found out later, I didn't think he was an alcoholic. I found later he was, excuse me, more of a periodic. But it's pretty much beside the point. if they didn't drink every day, I didn't get it. But anyway, there's a lot of social occasions involved with that kind of a position. It's not a good position for a person like me. Not that I had a drinking problem, but I had to have a couple of drinks to prepare so that I could talk to people. And then, of course, I had to have a drink with me throughout these fundraising occasions so that I could be comfortable. And, well, you know, if you're the first one to come and the last one to leave, unpredictable things happen, and they would happen. And so one night, they had a big dinner. It was the associates' dinner, and it was for all the people that contributed a lot of money. And my husband was in an administration that was all Mormon at that time. And so I had put a flask in my purse, and I had on a long formal gown. I had hair down to my waist. I had all my makeup on, and we went to the dinner, and I was adding a little libation to my coffee. They weren't drinking coffee. I don't know why I thought they wouldn't notice this. I became progressively funnier, which they also did not appreciate. And eventually, my husband called me outside, and he says, "You know, you're a total embarrassment to me. You're a total embarrassment to me, and I have called a cab for you to take you home." And I went home, and I looked in the mirror. And it should have been a moment of awakening, you know, the hair was now a little sideways, the lipstick was a little smeared, I wasn't looking too good. But I remember looking in the mirror and then saying, my God, what's wrong with my personality? Not for an instant did I think this had anything to do with drinking. It just missed me completely. That man eventually left me. I had a lot of resentments, and I could tell you a lot of awful reasons why, and I didn't realize until I did the steps of this program that it was my drinking that drove him away. And since I had planned on being married for life, that was a pretty hurtful occasion to me. And so the next thing that I did, my drinking progressed rapidly from that point on. And I sought lower companions. Now, I did not seek lower companions so I would fit in. I sought lower companions because I thought, as terrific as I was and as crummy as they were, they would never leave me. And I went to low-end bars, and bad things happened to me. You know, I was abused. I was raped on more than one occasion. I lived a lot as a victim after that. When I came to you, I had developed issues, and I thought the world had really done me wrong and that things could never be right. I had not grasped the concept at all that when I take a drink, I don't know what's going to happen next, and I'm at the mercy of the universe. I eventually got into a relationship. I can best describe it as a sick relationship. And when that woman left me, my world collapsed. I mean, it was one thing when this fine man left, but when the lower companion leaves, you have hit a whole new bottom. So, at 2 o'clock in the morning, which, by the way, 2 o'clock in the morning is the communication hour of the alcoholic. So at 2 o'clock in the morning, I called her on the phone. I wanted to make sure she fully understood what she'd lost out on. And so I called her on the phone, and she didn't seem to be paying very good attention. So I got my .357, which is a good, powerful pistol. Anyway, I got my .357 and I went over to her house. And my experience is when you have the .357, they listen better. Now, when the police came, I was naked, unconscious with the .357. To this day, I am not sure why naked was gonna help her listen better, but there you are. I was pretty sure it would. Anyway, they arrested me. I had a lot of resentment around it. I ended up losing my job because I was absent from work, because if you're detained, it's hard to show up. I mean, it could have happened to anybody. But I was arrested on a 5150. And for those of you that don't know what that is, that's the whacka whacka charge. You know, you might be of harm to yourself or others. And so while I was there, they said, were you drinking when this happened? You know, we alcoholics are not stupid. If I answer yes, they're gonna say stop. And this is the only solution in my life. So I said, of course not. Now they think you're nuts. And so I was in there for 3 days, and they had some other charges. And so, eventually, in the adjudication process, I was sentenced to see this therapist twice a week. Now, you have to remember, I started this as a lie. There's two things about an alcoholic like me and a lie. The first is, if I tell it three times, it becomes the truth. You know, I didn't tell you, I'm also a fly fisherman, so I have, like, multiple diagnoses. And we're not known for the truth either. In fact, there was a fish story about catching a very large fish on a small fly rod and all the trouble landing it and everything else. And, you know, even I found it hard to believe. But after I told it a few times, it had a ring of truth to it. So that's the first thing. I'm not known for telling the truth. And the second thing is, if I tell a lie, I honor it. So now I'm seeing the therapist, and I'm trying to maintain the lies, and I'm telling him all these stories. He's making diagnoses based upon those stories, and I'm going out and living the diagnosis. By the time I came to you, and I actually believed this, he diagnosed me as being bipolar. I now know I'm the brainstorm and the grouch. He diagnosed me with affective disorder and some kind of borderline something. But anyway, so I walked around. If you're not truly psychotic and you're on all those meds, what you get is a flat affect. Yeah, hi, my name's Sonia. It is a nice day. You know, it's a lot like that. Not too much happens. Most of who I thought were my friends abandoned me because, you know, now they considered me pretty dangerous. And things went downhill in a hurry in the last few years of my drinking. I never considered alcohol the problem. I thought I'd been born wrong. You know, I was a pretty nice person during the day, and then I just went bad after dark. I don't know. And so I decided the problem was all of you. You know, I'd gotten into these troubles in bars. I'd had all these bad things happen to me. I was less employable, so now I had a crummy job. You know, things weren't going well. And there was an accident down the street. And it was a truck with a big refrigeration unit on it. And I was a licensed professional who was now doing construction and building decks for a living. So, you know, it wasn't the career path I had picked. But I had made some contacts. So I got a guy across the bridge that had a big piece of equipment, and I went to the guy in the accident, and I bought the refrigeration box. You know, you've seen those on the truck, off the back of the truck. And I got this guy, I got a couple six-packs of beer, and I got him to dig a big hole in my backyard. And I poured footings into that hole, and he picked up that refrigeration unit, and he came, and we set that down in the hole. And I built steps down into that hole. I moved my scotch down there. I moved some fine wine down there. I wasn't a wine drinker, but I was about to become a connoisseur. And so I moved that down there. I put an easy chair down there. I piped in electricity from the house. And I thought, okay, now I can come home. I can sit down here. I'm going to be left alone. I'll read my book, because I'm an intellectual, and drink in peace, and life will be okay. And that's where I was 6 months before I quit drinking. My life had become that small. I think about that today. You know that part of the book where it says, you know, we have to make a decision whether to lead this spiritual path or continue into an alcoholic death, living the way we are. And I'm thinking, and I had a tough time with that. I mean, here I've got my box, and I got my chair, and it's like, well, I don't know if I should give this up for something. I don't even know if it's going to work yet. You know, and look at my life today. Anyway, my life continued. I still did not think I was an alcoholic. Well, actually, I said I was an alcoholic. I just didn't think it was a problem. And I knew lots of alcoholics, and if I ever wanted to quit drinking, I could. And so I was living with another lower companion at that time, and she was going to take a vacation with these other two gals, and I said, well, I want to go too, and she said, there isn't room for you. And I did not know that she had started attending Al-Anon, and I said, well, there's plenty of room in that car. It's a big sedan. And she said, well, the truth of it is, Sonia, that you can do what you want, but we need a vacation from your drinking. I was offended. I mean, what? And so I did the, I'll show you. I'm going to quit. That's all. I'm just going to quit. I waited for him to leave town. I am quitting. For a day, I told many people how I'd quit. Now, this is pretty funny because I had quit several times before. You know, I would quit late at night. I would quit early in the morning. I never, like, quit for a whole day. That seemed excessive. But but anyway, so I tried to quit. And the second time, I'm extolling the virtues of aqua pura. And by the third day, I'm getting sick. I'm getting really sick, and I'm not feeling well. And I played, I was pretty athletic back then, and I played in a fast pitch softball team. Chico is a big softball town, and a lot of people came out to watch. And I'd been on this team for a long time. And I went out to play, and you know, we're all gathered around before the game, and my coach says something that I don't like, you know, like hello in the wrong tone. And I reared back, and bam, I punched her, and she went down. I was 40 years old. There were over 200 people there. I was mortified. I had never done anything like that. And there I was, you know, and I looked at her, and I just fled. I just fled. I went home, and I stood in front of that mirror again. And I said, God, what's wrong with my personality? And I felt really bad. This woman had always been kind to me. You know, she would, well, we would go to her home sometimes to celebrate, and I would fall asleep. That's alcoholic talk for pass out. And so she would cover me with a blanket. I mean, she never commented on my drinking, and I felt terrible. So later that night, I called her on the phone, and I said, Jan, I feel really badly. You know, I didn't mean to do such a horrible thing, and I want to apologize. I said, you know, I'm having a problem with my personality. And for some reason that I didn't understand, I tacked on, and I'm trying to quit drinking. She says, are you willing to go to any length? I have no idea what that means. I didn't hang out with you guys, and I have no idea. And so I'm an alcoholic making a real apology here. We are nothing if not sincere. So I say, well, of course I am. She says, I'll be right over. It's a five-minute drive. It took her 45 minutes to get there. And I want to tell you something, if you're like I was when I was new. When I first quit drinking and I had to go anywhere, and I had to do some business things and stuff, I was so afraid people would notice I wasn't drinking. I was so afraid of being the square peg in the round hole while they were all busy fitting in. She had been sober 11 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had never noticed she wasn't drinking, ever. She never mentioned AA. She never said, oh no, I don't drink. You know, she never said, I'm an alcoholic. She just kept being kind to me and being a program of attraction. You know, she'd sometimes say no thanks. Now often when I'm in a group, I say, no thanks, I've had enough. But anyway, it took her 45 minutes to drive to my house. She had waited so long for this day that she sat down and read the entire chapter on working with others. And she came over and she told me her story. She did not talk to me about my drinking. She told me her story. And while she told me a few things she did, like I've told you today, what she really told me was how baffled she'd been. How baffled she'd been, how she'd make up her mind not to get in trouble drinking again. And then, but she didn't know she had a disease. And then she'd get this mental obsession. She'd get this thought that drove out all other thoughts. And the thought would say, you're more sensitive. You can't get through this without a drink. It would say, this time it'll be different. It would say, I'm only gonna have two. But she'd have that thought. You know, it talks about it in the book, and there is a solution. It says our problem centers in our mind, and our real problem is that mental state we're in just before we take the first drink. That's the real insanity. And I had never understood that. I thought it was when I lost my clothes at the class reunion. You know? I thought it was when I woke up in the back of the station wagon coming out of a blackout with my boss. You know, I thought that was the insanity. I didn't realize the insanity was that thought that this time it'll be different. And she said, then when I take that drink, I would trigger an allergy. And that allergy isn't a rash, and it isn't diarrhea, and it's not anything like that, but it's a different reaction than the other 9 out of 10 people have. It's a reaction that tells me when I have a drink, I need another one. And that reaction, that allergy, would trigger the craving. And she said, I didn't always get in trouble, But I never knew when I was going to drink too much and when I never knew I wasn't going to drink enough. I told you about my granddad, my favorite relative. When I was 16 years old, he passed away. And, God, I hated the pain. And I loved him so much. But I so did not want to be in that pain that I was just going to have one drink before his funeral. And then I had another drink. And I couldn't even show up for that event. So I knew what she meant. She said, I never meant to get drunk. I never meant to get in trouble. I just wouldn't understand what happened. And she said, and then I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I recognized that what the problem was. The problem was I had a disease that had a mental obsession, a physical allergy, and that allergy triggered, excuse me, that allergy triggered the craving to drink. And she said, and I found in Alcoholics Anonymous that there is a solution, you know, and I've elected to try that out. She said, I'd like to take you to a meeting in the morning. And I'm thinking, wow, I do kind of get it. I mean, I'm looking at her, I'm seeing it works, right? Now, I know it won't work for me because she's an alcoholic and I'm crazy. But I am making an apology, so I'm going to go. And, you know, back then we worked with a lot more wet drunks, and so she was pretty smart. She says, I'm going to spend the night. And whoops. And she did. And in the morning I said, I don't think I can go to that meeting. I was really sick, and I was starting to see things, and it was really bad. And she had worked with wet drunks, and she got that bottle of scotch down, and she gave me a drink. And she got me well enough to go to my first meeting. And, you know, I don't remember anything they said, and I don't remember what took place, but I remember that feeling. And they said, keep coming back, and I thought, well, I'm not an alcoholic, but I like you guys pretty well. I think I will. And so I kept coming back, you know, and these people were wonderful to me. They would come to my house. They would come to my house an hour before the meeting, you know, and they would help me get dressed. Every now and then they'd come an hour and a half and suggest I take a shower. But they'd help me get dressed. They'd drive me to the meetings. You know, they would read to me. They were just wonderful. Oh, they'd take me for ice cream. I hadn't had ice cream in 20 years, you know. But they really kept track of me. And I went to the two meetings a day that we had in Chico at that time. And that went really well for a while. And about 60 days, I got well. And I started going, well, about 50 days, I started going to two meetings a week. And at 60 days, I decided this deal didn't work. And there was a gal in the program, and I thought she was pretty cool. And so I didn't want to stay in AA, but I wanted to be buddies with her. So I went over to her house, and we have an intuitive sense, right? So I have this intuitive sense that when I tell her I'm leaving AA, she seemed pretty gung-ho about the whole deal, and this wasn't going to go over too well. So I'm humming and hawing around, and she says, listen, I know you're really shy, but I have to go to work, so I'm going to make this easy for you. Yes, I'll be your sponsor. And leaves. Oh, God. So now I have a sponsor. So that night we're at a meeting, and now I've worked up the courage, you know, because now I've spent all day rehearsing the speech. So after the meeting, I say to her, listen, that was really nice of you to offer to be my sponsor, but this program is not working for me. She said, really? Well, I got a couple of facts for you. First of all, you've only had a sponsor for 3 hours. And second of all, how dare you say this program doesn't work? You haven't worked it. You're in the fellowship. You go to meetings, you know, but you have not worked the program. And the program is in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, it was an interesting thing. When I got here, I was really willing. Up till that point, I had done everything everybody said, right? I was really willing, and I saw the problem. By then, I had read the first part of the book, and I could not only see myself in Jan, I could see myself in Bill's story. But over the next week, we went over those first four or five chapters again, you know, and I could see it clearly. So I saw the problem, and I had a certain amount of willingness, but the deal was I wasn't committed. I really didn't want to quit drinking. Here's what I wanted. I wanted you guys to answer two questions for me. The first one was, why can't I drink like I used to? And the second one is, why can't I stop when I want to? And if you just answer those two questions, I'd go on my way and life would be good. And so I get together with my sponsor and I say, listen, this is the deal. I said, alcohol is not a problem for me. Alcohol is a solution. It's been a solution for everyone in my family. It's genetic. I can't help it. And so alcohol is a solution. And she says, and I'm expecting an argument. I've got my seven things ready. And she says, yes, it is. Alcohol is the only tool in your toolbox. It's the solution to all your problems. And I have some shocking news for you. You can't drink. You can't drink like normal people. You know, you have proved that time and time again. And so you are absolutely right. You have no solution to your problem. And that's why we have to get in right now and get you through these steps. I found out since, and it's the same thing I do with people I sponsor, is the deeper they are in their alcoholism, the quicker we get through the steps. Because that period of time, see, I didn't think I had any problems when I drank. When I came to you, what I really thought was that I had 22 and a half years of successful drinking followed by an acute attack of alcoholism. Everything seemed to go bad at the end. And actually, they weren't that bad at the end. They seemed to go bad in those first few months after I quit drinking. I now know all I was more aware that the problem was there the whole time. But thank God for strong sponsorship. Thank God for her patience, and thank God for the fact that she took me through those steps. Before I even did the steps, she said, in fact, you need a solution so badly, I'm gonna direct you to a page in the book. It's a page I still remember, it's on page 19. And it says, we have to develop tolerance. This isn't exactly what it says, but it's the idea. Tolerance for the shortcomings and views of other people. We have to learn to respect our opinions because it makes us more useful to them. As ex-problem drinkers, our very lives depend on constant thought of others and how we may meet their needs. And it's before any of the action steps. Our constant thought of others and how we may meet their needs. I kind of thought being a greeter on Fridays was good enough, but so she said, you know, there's this guy named Earl, and Earl doesn't have a driver's license, and so I want you to take Earl to the Wednesday night meeting. I said, there's two problems with that. I don't like the Wednesday night meeting. They talk in code. She said, what do you mean? I said, well, they show off. They say, well, this, in the third step, blah, blah, blah. When I did my eighth step, blah, blah, blah. When I did my tenth step this morning, I said, how do I know what all that stuff is? They talk in code. Show offs. And I said, and the second problem is I don't like Earl. She said, well, I got some news for you. You're going to pick Earl up for the meeting every week, and you've just found your home group. I said, how long do I have to do that for? I'm thinking a month is pretty good. She said, a year. I said, a year? That seems excessive. She said, yeah, you're going to follow direction or you're not. You don't get to choose. So I picked Earl up for a year. I can't tell you how many Tuesdays I had a bad day and was thinking of drinking. I disliked Earl so much, I stayed sober just so he wouldn't be one up on me. At the end of a year, you'd think this is a nice story and it's going to end with how much I learned to like Earl. Nope. Didn't happen. But I stayed sober. And I'll tell you something else that happened at the end of that year. I had a feeling of accomplishment I haven't had in years. It was the first time I made a commitment that I actually followed through the whole thing and did the deal. I was the person that wanted to be president of the club. I just didn't want to do the work of president. You know, so So we started on that part of the journey. And I did my fourth and fifth step. And I want to tell you something about that, because first I misunderstood the fourth and fifth step. You know, I thought it was kind of a confession of all the dirty, awful things I'd ever done. And I didn't realize that it was part of our design for living. I didn't realize that it was intended to let me know the things that were blocking me from having the life I wanted to have, you know. That those resentments, I was so full of resentments, I was mad at just about everybody. And I was full of fear. I was full of fear, especially fear of being found out, because even sober, the things I did weren't, well, they just didn't meet this esteemable definition. And I had remorse over the harms I'd done to others, you know. And so I was so filled up with that stuff, there really wasn't room for anything else. So when we finished the third step, and she wants me to start on this fourth step, I said, well, I can't do that. I said, I don't have a higher power. She said, I'll tell you when you need one. I said, well, the other problem is, as you know, I'm crazy, and I think I have multiple personalities. And she said, I don't care as long as they all work the steps. I've always enjoyed that. So I'm doing service, and I'm doing this fourth and fifth step, and it was just my, it was just the big stuff on the first time around. Now it's a tool I absolutely love. But I got into service, you know, and I got into local service. She was DCM at that time, and she used to take all the people she sponsored, and we'd all have to pile in the van and go to the area conferences so we could see what AA was really like. And I really got involved in the deal. You know, I started having that sense of purpose, and things started to change for me. I stayed very involved in service. You know, I did the best sixth and seventh step I could at that time, which was actually pretty simple, because the first time around on character defects, it wasn't like many errors in thinking. It was actual stuff I could change doing, you know, like just being more courteous. You know, so I had to learn to say, well, I'm walking down the hall and someone's in my way. I had to learn to say, excuse me, instead of get out of my way. You know, so these character defects weren't that big a challenge for me. I had to learn that when I said I was going to be there, to show up. I had to learn to show up for work 10 minutes early instead of 5 minutes late. I had to learn to see what I could contribute to the day, not to look into the unfairness of what I'd done. And now that said, I did not get much of a sense of relief after the fourth and fifth step or in that process. You know, and in fact, I want to tell you what part of what I did. I told you some of, in briefly, what happened when I was drinking and how I was such a victim when I came to you. I now knew I had a dysfunctional family, and I'd had all these other things happen to me, and I'd had bad bosses, and I'd been rejected. It's a sad tale. I just won't go any more into it. But when I was first in the program, and I don't mean the first few months, I mean the first few years, a lot of my shares revolved around a series of excuses and explanations so you would know what a terrible life I had, so you would know everything I'd been through, so you would know how I had suffered and how they done me wrong. And the reason for that was, it was easier for me to excuse how I am today than to make the changes I need to make to be the woman I can be. You know, today, if I catch myself in excuse mode, it's one of the first things I shut off. In fact, I've got a little saying, you know, when I talk too long, I'm usually making an excuse, either that or telling a lie that I'm trying to still make sound convincing. And so I've got this little acronym, and when I catch myself doing it, I try right away. I go, wait. And it's short for, why am I talking? And sometimes I have to follow it with, wait, that isn't true. You know, because my life is so good today that when I start down those paths, I want to nip it a lot earlier than I used to. So here's what happened. I did the eighth and ninth step and made some amends. They didn't all go well. I went into one florist shop. not even to make amends, but to buy flowers for someone else I was making amends to. And the florist started screaming to me that she had told me never to come into her store again. Blah, 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 blah. And it was like, okay. So, you know, when you get sober in your hometown, it can be that way. But I did my side of the street. And I was about 8 months sober, and I woke up one morning. Now, one of the things I had feared when I was drinking was I had a terrible fear of going to sleep at night. I had a terrible fear. I may have some fears today, but I never have the terror that I had then. And I would sometimes try and drink to that perfect point and then start down the hall. And I would wake up down the hall and have to come back and have another drink. Anyway, at about 8 months, I woke up one morning, and I had slept all night. And I realized it wasn't the first time I had slept all night. And suddenly, I knew I had a higher power. Up until then, good things would happen, and my sponsor would say, oh, your higher power is working in your life. And I'd smile and say yes, and my mind would think, I did that. If it was bad, God did it. If it was good, I did it. But at that point, I knew there really was a higher power. My life began to change. After I worked the steps, I started sponsoring people right away. And I was afraid to do that because I thought I wouldn't be good at it. And my sponsor said, no, while you first work the steps, it's a perfect time to start sponsoring. And the only way to get better at sponsoring is to do sponsoring. So I started. I'll tell you just a couple things that happened to me in early sponsorship. There was this little gal, and my sponsor had done it to me, so I offered to sponsor her. And she meekly said yes, and I said, okay. You know, read such and so, and we'll meet next Wednesday and discuss it. You know, so it's the stuff about the first step. We meet on Wednesday, and I said, did you do the reading? She said, no. I said, that's okay, I'll read it to you. And so I read it to her, and I said, now read the second step. Okay, so we come back the next week, and I said, did you read the second step? And she said, no. And I said, that's okay, I'll read it to you. The next week, it's the same thing, the third step, and I go home, and my sponsor says, how's that going with your new sponsee? I said, well, you know, it's going well, but I feel so sorry for her. You know, she can't read. She said, what do you mean? And I tell her the story. She said, did you ask her if she can read? And I said, no. She said, if I were you, I'd ask her. So the next week, I asked her, and she said, well, of course I can read. I'm really not too interested in this AA deal, but you were being so nice, I just didn't know what to say. 10 years later, I was speaking down in California, and this gal comes up to me, and I don't recognize her. And she tells me her name, and she said, yeah, you know, it took me another 9 years to get here, but I always remembered how kind you were reading to me, and now I have almost a year. So you never know where that's going, but I got better at it. I guess I had about a year and a half when there was another gal that, my sponsor and I went to call on this gal at home, much like people had done with me, and she's older, and she's disheveled, and she's smelly, so we take her to the meeting, and she's obnoxious in the meeting. She's rattling her cane and doing all her stuff, so at the end of the meeting, my sponsor says to me, she says, I want you to take Ruth to coffee. I said, what? She said, take Ruth to coffee. I said, oh my God, she's so obnoxious, it'll be embarrassing. She looks at me and she says, aren't you the one? Look how the ego recovers, you know. Do you forget how you were? Now you take this woman to coffee, because it's easy to love the lovable, but this is the real alcoholic. So I take her to coffee. I pick her up for the meeting the next day. She's just as obnoxious. I take her to coffee again. I do this for about 3 days, and then this little light turns on in my head, and it says, you sponsor people. I called my sponsee. I said, I got this lady I want you to pick up for the meeting. Yes. We get to the end of the meeting. I said, I want you to take this lady to coffee. She says, are you kidding? It'll be so embarrassing. I said, aren't you the one? So, if you have any hesitation about sponsorship, there's the motive right there. Isn't Alcoholics Anonymous fun? I've had a lot of gifts as a result of this program, and I've had a lot of growth since those early days, but I'll tell you, it sure is fun to think back on them and tell them all to all of you. You know, I love this deal. I love Alcoholics Anonymous, not just for what it's done for me. When I came here, I thought my life was over, you know, and I mean, it was okay, but it was going to be pretty boring not drinking. I couldn't even mow the lawn without drinking. It was grim, and it's not that way today. I can't fit everything in. And I have lots of blessings. You know, I'd always bemoaned my lack of advancement at work. Well, we're like that, you know. We like to start at the top, work our way down. But I had a job in which I'd been hired by exception. And I was doing a good job now, but I couldn't get ahead. And, you know, for years I had talked about going back to school. And my sponsor said, well, you know, when you go back to school, the first thing you need to do is, I said, I'm so afraid, all these kids know computers now and this and that. She said, the first thing you have to do is apply. So I applied to 11 schools and 9 rejected me and 2 accepted me. And then I was scared to death. I said, oh man, I don't know, you know, I can't, statistics and this and that. And so anyway, she said, well, if you don't know something, just ask for help. Well, I learned a few things. The first thing I learned is when you're older and an Alcoholics Anonymous and have learned to show up and you come to every class, right there you're ahead of half the people there. You don't have to do anything. And then you ask for help. They are so tickled that someone really wants to know. They will help you. And so eventually I got my doctorate. And I don't say that to brag because it's a gift from Alcoholics Anonymous and all of you. I got the doctorate. As a result of the doctorate, I got a job I absolutely loved in a career in a health system, and it was a job I never dreamed I'd have, you know, and I loved that job. Julie and I had a business before I got that job, and we wrote 2 books, and we got to travel to all these national conventions and promote our book. I mean, who would have thought that? Which brings me to one of the greatest gifts of my sobriety is my relationship of 30 years with Julie. You know, that's roughly 25 years longer than any other relationship I've been in. And 29 years and 200 days longer than 90% of them. But anyway, it's a relationship that we try and practice the principles of the program. And it's a relationship that's built on trust. And it's built on respect. And we have so much fun together. We have a great life together. You know, in October, Julie went into the hospital for a minor procedure. And while she was waiting in short stay for it to start, they always have a little EKG on you, and I noticed things weren't going well, and they were going worse and worse. And Julie could tell from my expression that things weren't well. They had called a cardiologist, as she got progressively worse, you know, I grabbed hold of her and I told her how much I loved her, and she told me how much she loved me, and we talked about all the fun we'd had together and what a great life it's been, and then her heart stopped. Right then, the cardiologist they had called 10 minutes before came into the room, they coded her, they did the drugs, they took her straight in and did a procedure. And she's here with me today, you know. Thank God. But you know, one of the things that we said at that time is, it's going to be okay. We both said it. And we didn't mean just if she pulled through it. We both knew it was absolutely going to be okay no matter what. Because we both walk in the hand of our higher power today. It was one of the most significant moments of my entire life. It wasn't the first thing that's happened in sobriety, but it's certainly where I am today. Julie and I have a fifth wheel. We travel all over the country, all over the West. I like to exaggerate a little, but. Okay, so once we went to Mount Rushmore. All right. But we do a lot of stuff in Oregon and Washington. Anyway, we have a great time and we've made great friends. And, you know, I've said that miracles have come true for me as a result of this program. One of the things I've gotten more in touch with, and I know some of you have heard me talk a lot about the sixth and seventh step before because it's absolutely my favorite steps, but I've been using a lot, I've been doing the tenth step, you know, and trying to make it more constant, not doing my kindergarten version where I check it all out at night, but trying to stop myself when I'm in fear at 2 o'clock and say, what is it? You know, what is it in my reaction to the situation so I can fix it right then? You know, when I'm rude at 4 o'clock, making the amends right then and trying not to do it again. And as a result of some of that work, you know, Julie and I have had the miracle. I can't speak for her, but it seems like she has. I have had the miracle that it talks about in the 10th step, that position of neutrality where alcohol is concerned. You know, that ability to be happy in the rooms of AA where I absolutely love to be, but happy out in the world too. I used to just walk through the world and then rush back into AA. So Julie and I have gotten to do a lot of fun things. We have a lot of friends in AA, and we have some areas in which we are a definite program of attraction. And so anyway, a couple of years ago, Julie and I wanted to take Julie on this special fishing trip. And it was to go down the Smith River in Montana. It's the only permit river in Montana. It's like a 5-day float. It's absolutely beautiful. And the trip was all booked. But I get a call and they have a cancellation. And so we take it and we get there. And the other three boats are these six guys that have fished together for years. And not only is it two other people, I mean, just imagine you see the two of us walking up and we're your new fishing buddies. Plus the fact that we have learned to follow directions. And so before lunch, Julie had caught seven fish on her fly, and I'd caught two, and none of those guys had caught any. I tried to take pictures of them, you know, because I make DVDs so that people can enjoy experiences later, but every picture, when I looked at it, they were flipping us off. So anyway, that night, they're gathered around the campfire, and when we go on trips like that, we socialize for a while, and then when it becomes male bonding time, we head for our tent. So we headed for the tent, and we're in there reading, and alcoholics are funny. They think tents are soundproof. And so we're in our tent. This has nothing to do with anything. But anyway, we're in our tent, and they're out there. They're starting to drink, and now they're getting into the, oh, that kind of maudlin thing. I love you, man. Oh, I love you, too. Oh, I wasn't remember when we did such and so. And Julie and I are in there. We're trying not to laugh so loud that they can hear us. And anyway, so they go on well into the night. And the next morning, we get up for breakfast, and we're all lined up, and they're serving eggs. And these guys aren't feeling too well. And this particularly obnoxious guy is across from me, and he says, I hear you're a pharmacist. I said, yeah. He says, well, I have a question about my medication. I said, okay, I'd be happy to help you. I think he's finally being friendly. He says, yes, it's my Viagra. My mouth comes open. I have not yet thought of the retort, and Julie doesn't miss a beat. She says, Viagra, I love Viagra. Oh, my God. Sonia brings it home from work. I crush it up. I put it on my tomatoes. I don't have to stake them all year. Oh, God. So at the end of that trip, they give an award. It's sometimes to one of the camp workers, sometimes to one of their fishermen, but they give an award of who they'd most like to go on another fishing trip. And at the end of that trip, they gave the award to Julie. So we don't think any of them are sober, but we're out there trying. So I had that wonderful job, and I thought one of the saddest days in my life. You know, I never know God's will for me. I always think that I know. And so anyway, they restructured, and that job ended in 2008. And I came home, and the phone rang, and this guy asked me to do an exploratory trip. I fly fished for about 50 years. And so I get to go up to the River No Return Wilderness and fly in and go on mules and check out this area that no one's fished in years, you know, and I get to figure it out, do the flies, teach his guides to be fishing guides, and just have this wonderful time. And as a result of that, I start getting asked to do it in other places. I went to Alaska 3 times. I got to go to Argentina. I've been to Costa Rica. I did some work for the government of Senegal. So about partway through this, I start asking these guys. I said, you know, there's a lot of guys that do a really good job of this. Why are you asking me? And they said, well, it's an interesting thing. Everybody will go on the trip, and a lot of them are good anglers, and they'll, you know, do the deal. But they don't write their report, and you always make a nice DVD to show at fly fishing shows. You know, I've heard if I don't want to go do it, that you'll give the talks at the fly fishing show for me. And so in short, it's because you do what you say you're going to do. So clear until 2 years ago, I just had this wonderful deal. I mean, I didn't really make any money, but I got to go places I thought I'd never get to go. And I got to do a thing I love, and I got to meet people from all over, and I got to give these talks at fly fishing clubs and fly fishing shows. You know, and all because you taught me to do what I say I'm going to do. Julie and I are really glad to be here today. You know, we've both had a lot of things come up. In January, I went to Portland to have a heart procedure, and it was scheduled. And while we were in Portland, Julie had an emergency, and the only opening on the schedule was right after me. And so we ended up, it's great. You know, after 30 years, most couples just get each other matching T-shirts. No. So we have cardiac procedures on the same day. And this was absolutely amazing to me. Now, I've always shown up to help other people. You know, it's something I learned in AA. But I never really thought anyone would show up for me. I never really believed that. And first of all, I'll bet 20 people called. It's about a 5-hour drive to Portland from where I live. At least 20 people called and offered to bring us home because we hadn't planned on this, you know, and she was going to drive and do all that. And then neither one of us could lift more than 5 pounds. There were all these restrictions. And so a friend of ours did this thing online called Meal Train, and I thought, and they bring a meal out to your home and people sign up for it. And I thought, well, no one will sign up. We're a 35-minute drive from our meetings. And in about 2.5 hours, the whole 2 weeks filled up. And people brought us meals. And the best part of it was they didn't just bring the meal. They would sit and visit for 30 minutes while they were there. And if something needed to be done, because we couldn't even carry out the garbage, they'd carry out the garbage. They'd do all these wonderful things for us. And you know, it was hard for me. It was hard for me because I learned how to give, but I hadn't really learned a lot about how to receive. You know, and it was a great lesson for me to how to receive the love that's here from the fellow members of Alcoholics Anonymous. The other thing that carried me through this period of time and is still carrying me is the people I sponsor. The people I've sponsored have called on their regular schedule, and I am so happy when they have problems because it distracts me from mine, you know, and so it's just another gift of sponsorship. I've always enjoyed it, but I've never enjoyed it as much as I do right now. So this deal has been absolutely beyond anything I imagined. You know, I truly am living the dream. What I thought was a group of steps that would just help me not drink has one day at a time given me a design for living, a way to be happy each and every day, well, as happy as I make up my mind to be. And you know, when I was going out and having a drink, I never, ever, ever, I would not be a person that stands at the podium and says, you know, I set out to get drunk every time I drink. I never set out to get drunk. I just wanted that sense of ease and comfort. I just wanted to feel like I fit in the universe. I just wanted to be okay inside of me. And what I found out is, not only by learning how to live, I don't have to drink one day at a time. But when I walk into a room, when I walk into a meeting before anyone has said anything, I feel that sense of ease and comfort that I was looking for all along. And I thank each and every one of you for that.